KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. This is an episode I recently recorded with a live audience during the LA Film Festival with writer-director Justin Lin talking about the Fast and Furious films.
The first thing I think of when I see your movies is bringing the subversive. I mean, you really want to like shock audiences, make people think. And you found a way to do that with Fast and Furious films just by bringing Han into the movie from Better Luck Tomorrow. How many people here have seen Better Luck Tomorrow? How many people were like, wait, is that Han from Better Luck Tomorrow? Talk about how you came up with that idea of bringing him aboard.
It was really interesting because when they approached me to do Tokyo Drift, they found me in London. I was shooting there, and I had read the script, and they called me. I said, thank you. No, I'm okay. I don't want to do it. And they said, well, you should really come in. Stacey Snyder's ahead of the studio. You should take that meeting. So I went into the meeting to tell him no. But she was so great. She said, why? I explained why I found it, you know, potentially offensive, this and that.
No, you can't start with this and that. Potentially offensive.
Well, when I read it, it was a script where, you know, they had cars drifting next to Buddha statues and geisha girls. And it was just, as a film viewer, I found it kind of offensive. It was seen through that lens of Hollywood. And to her credit, she said, look, I really want you to do it. It's going to start shooting in 2 months. Do whatever you want. And so I thought, okay, that's a good exercise, you know. And as I was writing it, I really was thinking of Han a lot. So I decided, let's, you know, when we were doing the Better Luck Tomorrow tour, everybody asked, what happened to the characters? Because the open-ended kind of ending. And I thought, okay, I'll give him that. I'll bring Han into the Fast and Furious world.
And what did he say when you sprung this on him?
Oh, he was happy. He gets to work.
But I mean, part of the two is you didn't just bring the name. You actually brought that character into that mix. And it was also interesting, too, because that was the kind of reboot of the series. I mean, you were taking it to another country, to another culture, to something that really wasn't even that well known outside of Asia. It felt to me like it had a lot of the hallmarks of the things you like to do. I mean, to the extent of, I often think of your work as kind of like, you know, the indie version of the Marvel Universe, where you connect all these strands.
It's funny, everybody says Marvel Universe, and when I was a kid, I never read comic books and stuff. It was actually Golden Girls that inspired me. Because this one Saturday, I don't know if you guys remember, they had
the hurricane episodes.
And you were like, wait, God. Empty Nest is in the same universe as the Golden Girls? And so anyway, that was the...
So it's Susan Harris who was your real inspiration.
Fast and Furious, you wouldn't be here without that.
If only you found a way to get Rue McClanahan into the movie, then it would have been
Betty White. I'm Betty White. I'm a Betty White man.
But that idea of connecting all these things together, though, and also using a big cast. I mean, there were a lot more characters to be serviced in Tokyo Drift than there were in the other Fast and Furious films.
And it's also, to me, it was an exercise of switching the sensibility of a franchise. I felt like when I got onto that set, there was some already, you know, Fast and Furious had become so big. Even some of the crew members, it's almost like a Fast and Furious button they push. You know, they think that it's neon cars, it's this look. And it's trying to change that culture was, you know, behind the scenes. That was very interesting to me.
But also, too, by taking these characters and using the movies as a way to sort of deal with perceptions about stereotypes, women and Asians and the hip-hop world. I mean, I just liked in that, for example, in Tokyo Drift, I just love the Atari Teenage Riot song. And I mean, it's just this way, sort of like that kind of postmodern punk that those guys do.
For me, it was a great exercise. And at the same time, I felt like being an indie filmmaker going in, the studio really kind of gave me a lot of latitude, you know, and I got to give Universal a lot of credit because they, you know, I think a lot of times when you do sequels, they tend to get very conservative because it's the money they're spending is so much. And for them to be open, and I tell them, I want to evolve this. I want to do Tank. I want to do Vault. And they're like, okay. You know, that took a lot of trust. And so I think the point of entry was very interesting. And for us to be able to develop that relationship, and every time I'd go in with some crazy idea and they're open to it, that's a great relationship.
And what struck me about it too was, because the second film was basically kind of a remake of the first one, you sort of bring in, by getting a new cast, you got a chance to reboot, but also dealing with the way youth tries to sort of like deal with what's perceived to be maturity, or they're supposed to be growing up and they're really not, which is in a big part, a big theme in Tokyo Drift, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that was, in many ways, there was kind of the sequel to Better Luck Tomorrow, yeah. You know, in exploring identity and to be able to do it kind of in a different genre.
But also exploring identity, basically being outside of your comfort zone. I mean, those kids in Better Luck Tomorrow were basically trying to sort of plant a flag and say, we're this despite what you think of us, but they're still kind of displaced. And that displacement is key, really, to all the movies, but you started with Tokyo Drift.
Yeah. I'm glad you noticed. I mean, that was just something that it was very organic that when I started working on the script, that it just felt like, I think that's why Han ended up there. It was something, it wasn't anything I was trying to do consciously. It was just kind of more organic.
But that sense, even in Annapolis, that sense of people like not trying to sort of affirm that they belong in this place that they really don't belong in, is key to the way you work.
And I think that's, you know, I think that no matter what kind of films a filmmaker does, it's going to, if you have a point of view, you know, it's going to rub off, you know, and I feel like that's been my exploration in the last 10 years.
But also even using films to ask questions about mythology. I guess when I saw you at Sundance, when you got your Bruce Lee film which is, again, you're just asking these questions about stereotypes or archetypes, and also even just sort of showing how the people were lost without this myth to cling to.
Yeah, and also the layers of even lies that we tell ourselves, you know, the explorations of that.
But also the way these people are all influenced by media. I mean, and they take their lead from In Better Luck Tomorrow, and then the Bruce Lee film is the same thing, too. Basically, people are kind of adrift. I hate to use adrift again, but kind of lost without something to sort of like tie themselves to for some kind of cultural identity.
And I think that's, again, for me, all these films, when I'd make Better Luck Tomorrow, people say, well, that's your background. Aside from the fact that they're Asian American characters, I didn't really know those characters. I worked with those kids, and I wanted to explore that identity, or the idea of kind of shopping for identity, and that's grown, and it's a new generation thing that interests me.
It's also a real kind of like first generation American thing too. I mean, being like a, in a way, kind of a cultural pioneer in the place that's already formed, is this, when you go to all these different cities, it feels like that same thing, you know, just trying to figure out who and what you are.
I think even more than that, I think with the media blowing up in the last 10 years, it's not even the first generation American thing, it's just American thing now. You know, especially kind of now, I had an opportunity to kind of venture into the YouTube world and seeing how specific that world is. And the fact that if you're even trying to kind of widen the experience a little bit, you're going to get resistance, you know, and how do you develop that relationship, how you can evolve that relationship. That's something I'm excited to kind of figure out still.
Is that a tough thing to do in the YouTube world? I mean, do you find people there waiting for expectations to be met as well?
Very much. And I mean, it's YouTube, you know. The audience, they're superstars. There's Ryan Higa, there's Chester C, Kev Jumba. These guys are there, and they have millions of followers and viewers. And it's very interesting because they have that really intimate relationship with the audience, you know. And I think doing the more traditional media, I mean, the only time we get that kind of relationship is usually in a test screening or something, you know, because when you get to the premieres and stuff, that's not even real anymore. So to be able to get that kind of immediate feedback, it affects the way you create, and it's refreshing also, but at the same time, it's the scariest thing.
But it's this thing you're saying, it's this immediate reaction. I mean, people just post a bad comment and then they tune out forever.
Yeah. I mean, it's for a free experience, it's brutal.
But you brought this up. Did you have to deal with test screenings for Tokyo Drift, for example?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's always about how you view an experience. I like test screenings, you know, and I don't like reading the cards. I like sitting in that room. It's the scariest thing to do, but to get an audience to be together and for them to be able to react to something, it's so organic, you know, you can't fake that. You know, there's 650 people there. When they laugh together, something's working. You know, you can feel the energy in that room. And the cards, for me, you can read it and stuff, but it still doesn't tell the right story.
I've had filmmakers tell me before that you get a room where people are with it and they're loving it, and they feel somehow when they get the cards, they have to like prove that they're smart, or that they, and they sort of say things that contradict the reactions in the room.
Yeah, and also at the same time, it's very leading, those cards. I mean, because I remember when we, when Better Luck Tomorrow got purchased by Paramount and MTV Films, they were testing that movie, and you just felt like, you know, because of the ending of that movie, the score was never going to go above like a 50, which is very low. You know, and when you talk to them and you find out, the reason is they didn't like the ending. But they're not supposed to like the ending.
I just remember you, as you bring this up, seeing of audiences, I was there with you at that screening at Sundance, where people were obviously moved by this movie. And I find this thing that I want to ask you about this, that may happen, is when people are being moved in the direction they've not been moved before, they get angry about it because they don't quite know how to articulate it.
Yeah, and I think it was very interesting for me because I... You know, that was just my second or first solo film. And we were hoping to kind of engage people and start a discourse. But to be in that room and feel that kind of anger, it was, it's something that I think I would deal with it differently now. But it was, you could feel that wave of energy hitting you. And it was everything we wanted, but it was nothing like we expected.
Because the responses were so primal? I mean, because people were just kind of just saying no to it instead of thinking. I just remember saying, listen, you guys have just had stereotypes exploded for you, and you don't know how to deal with it.
There were a lot of words in that room, but I remember that they were trying to clear out the library for the next screening, and people would not move for an hour. And it was that energy that I can't even articulate to this day.
No, but I think it was finally what it was a powerful experience that people wanted to talk about, which must have led you to believe that you'd done something along the lines of what you wanted with it.
Yeah, I think definitely the discourse that was in that room, I was glad that it was happening. I wish I could have participated more in that. But
you
it was
shell-shocked. Yeah, I just want to look on your face.
Yeah.
But it's because it's a lot to sort of get. I mean, in the abstract, you're saying, I want to provoke audiences. I want them to walk out of this movie talking about it and thinking about it. And that thing that maybe film festivals don't really prepare filmmakers for is to be hit by something like that in the room full of people who finally just want to be heard. I mean, they do want to have a discussion about it, which is what you want too.
And yeah, I mean, that's what's so great about film festivals. And now being having some years under me, it's something that doesn't happen all the time. Even when you're looking for a fight, you might not you might not get it. You know, it is something that is very special. And then once there, you want to be able to really kind of delve in and get into it.
And obviously, in staging Tokyo Drift the way that you did, and just really sort of taking us inside that culture where Bow Wow and Lucas Black are just kind of lost in it. I mean, that to me was really you transporting a big part of Better Luck Tomorrow into a big studio film.
Yeah, and with Bow Wow and Lucas, it wasn't hard. I mean, they were just eating McDonald's every day.
Really?
In Tokyo. Yeah. And complaining how McDonald's in Tokyo doesn't taste the same as the one in the States.
Wow, that's shocking. Thank God they were there to give you that news flash. But you kind of felt it from them because they kind of weren't really evolved enough actors to hide it. So it becomes part of this thing they bring to the movie whether they want it to or not.
And I think that's part of the fun of doing the fast movies too, because a lot of times, you know, I always equate it to driving a car, but at the same time you're building the road as the car is moving. You know, so as a filmmaker, I try to kind of see what's happening and try to utilize that. And very quickly with both Lucas and Bow Wow, both when I saw what they were going through, I was using that as we were kind of developing it and working on the film.
We'll take a break. More with Justin Lin when we return.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Welcome back to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Recently, I recorded an episode with a live audience with writer-director Justin Lin discussing the Fast and Furious films at the LA Film Festival.
One of the things I was telling you, too, before we sat down is I think you sort of see this essential quality that actors have that doesn't often get used. And your use of Dwayne Johnson, who always strikes me as a little engine that could. He's always, like, revved up. No matter what he's doing, even if he's supposed to be sad, he's, like, grinding his teeth. And sort of, I can cry. I know I can do this, man. And just to sort of take that momentum and turn it into this bulldog who has to get this bone no matter what was such a smart idea. He was born to play a villain.
It was great because I remember going to his house and meeting him, and he was great, but he was always, you could feel like sitting down.
He's wound up, isn't he?
He's always wound up. So as I was kind of pitching him what I wanted for the character, I kept adjusting it because I'm just studying him at the same time. It was amazing because I think when we were coming up with that character, I knew what that character was, but seeing him, I thought it'd be stupid not to incorporate what's in front of you, you know? And getting to meet them and saying, okay, let's bring them into the family, let's develop something. I love doing that. You know, I think having that ensemble feel. And you can, I think part of the fun is getting to know them as actors, as people, and incorporating that back.
Well, you just said, for what you did with Ludacris and Tyrese, just turning them into this comedy team. You know, which of us can be pettier than the other? So it becomes this kind of weird macho competition between them.
It's very, you know, I've gotten to know them pretty well, and they're very, I don't want to say they're very close to these characters, but a lot of these jokes are coming straight from the set, so.
Well, that begs the question, though. How much room in the context of that is there for improvisation, given that there are these notes, these expositional notes that have to be hit?
It's a juggling act, you know. I think you cannot improv a tank coming out of a truck. You have to plan it. I have other units shooting in other continents, and I have to make sure that, you know, the lenses are right, and we're always in constant communication. But at the same time, there's certain, as I'm developing it, I have to leave room for the characters. You know, I know the essence of what I'm trying to get, but when Tyrese is sitting there complaining about how he's getting his ass kicked in the subway, it became very clear to me that he had to have the last line in that sequence. So that's what I love. I think as I'm kind of growing as a filmmaker, I think things slow down a little bit, you know, so that we can have a 150-day shoot schedule. And to be in there and knowing that fight was supposed to take 3-4 days, we shot it in one day.
Which fight?
The one with Tyrese. And
yeah. So I thought you bet the one between... with Gia and, I mean...
Well, you know, a lot of times the favela chase in Fast Five, you know, it was 2 weeks before production. It was supposed to be in Rio, and it got taken out. The studio came and said, you don't have enough money. We're taking out of Rio. Wow. And I remember sitting there with the crew, and everybody is just beaten. I looked at the AD, and I said, how much time do we have? He said, a day and a half. And I said, let's do it. So we went and found a village in Puerto Rico and shot the whole thing in a day and a half. If you really watch the film... It was basically, it's the indie tricks, you know. I literally would have Vin getting prepped to jump off the building, and I would go shoot Paul and Jordana running down that, and we would just keep rotating it. And everything was shot within pretty much 100 feet of each other. and it's become this game where the studio always takes things away from me, and I still, you know, we still figure a way to shoot
it. Oh, yeah, I can show you. I can do this. That way they go, whoa, we're going to give you any more money the next time. But, I mean, the other thing that operates in the movies, too, so much is at a certain point, basically by the end of the second act, there's a lot of fear. I mean, you really sort of crank up. It's not just suspense. It's this real fear about what's going to happen. I mean, they kind of all got themselves into something that's a little bit bigger than they expected.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the fun. I think organic with the characters, but if you even take a step back of genre, you know, I mean, they're in a place that they're never supposed to. And I think even... In Fast Six, there's a lot of times I would get on set and see the cast, and you'd say, wow, like we are really transforming them. And so I think we have to use that now, you know, in a very organic way, but, you know, in the genre sense too.
Yeah, because you can't just, if you're going to keep bringing them back and making them superheroes, then you would just get bored by yourself.
Yeah, and this is a spoiler, but two of the characters kind of get it at the end of Six, and that was the biggest fight till the very end, and I felt like it was important that some of these characters have to have ends. They can't just keep living. And the reason why certain characters are beloved is because they do have a beginning and an end. But these are discussions that, you know, I think when you get into that world, you always have, and I think it's worth it, because then sometimes it gets almost physical in these fights.
Does it? I mean, because I can imagine the actor you told this to was really shocked by. Really shocked.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, the thing I've learned, I've always thought like actors would like to die or play the bad guy, you know, and like they don't like to die.
Well, but who knows, they're really dead in your movies anyway, for God's sakes. But I mean, I just, as you talk about this, you just remind me of something that both Howard Hawks and Walter Hill have said, with action is character.
I love it because, you know, it's like sports. You know, I can sit here and tell you what a great basketball player I am. But if we go on the court, you're going to know within 5 seconds if I'm good or not. You know,
let's go. We've got a court set outside just for this. Yeah.
And I always think that sometimes in films, people kind of, they discount the idea of action. To me, it's valuable real estate. This is when you can really explore these characters and go right into the subtext of who they are at that point in their lives.
Well, we can't talk about action and character and not talk about one of my favorite things you've done, which is the Modern Warfare episode of Community. Well, you really, I mean, again, we're talking about the first season of a show and a comedy, where usually what happens in comedy is people are kind of always the same. But that episode is really a test of who all those people were on the show. Talk about, I guess, was it one of the Russo brothers? A fellow indie veteran who called you into this mix?
Yeah, I mean, it was great. It was between 4 and 5. I got a call from Joe, and he said, hey, do you want to do this comedy show? And he sent over the pilot and the script, and I read it, and I thought, definitely, whatever. And it was great to be able to kind of explore the comedy genre. You know, doing the action stuff is tough, and it takes a lot of prep, a lot of, you know, you're up 24 hours, you're going, and but comedy, to me, is the scariest thing. Because if you don't get it, you don't get it. You know, you don't get on set, you don't get it. You know, I think we're in a business where a lot of times people like to just typecast, you know, like they, you know, they look at the film and they think, okay, it's action, so you just do action. And I think I give Joe a lot of credit for asking me to be a part of that. And I was very fortunate. You know, Dan Harmon is a great writer, and to show up and to see the way he works, it's just a pleasure to kind of work with him and to be able to kind of help enhance what he's created, you know. So I've never gone through anything like it with him where you'd get a script and you say, wow, this is funny, this is great. And then that script gets taken away, and then you get another script and you're like, wait, why did they just rewrite everything? Is it funnier? And then that gets taken away, and the third one comes and you're like, wow, this is better than the first one. And, you know, this idea of never letting up, and every second, you know, you don't give an inch, and you keep fighting and keep fighting. That, I think, is, you know, I love working that way, and I love working with people that work that way. And I think that is what kind of give Winger and all the other characters that little edge, is always just working and reworking it.
No, but just with that thing you've done in those episodes with Jeff, what really is sort of about him having to sort of finally sort of find himself physically after all these things are stripped away, and just sort of deal with these kind of elemental fears. Again, these are almost to be characters that you created. And it's just funny that you managed to find your way to these things even when you're not writing them, that are part of the way that you think about character.
I think the approach, I think, you know, the exercise coming from the indie world, a lot of times, you know, I hear people say all the time, like, you do one for you, you do one for them. Right. I actually, having gone through it, I don't know how you do that. You kind of have to do it all for you. Like, you know, you're the one that's getting up at 2 a.m. to set up the day, you know, to work 20 hours and then go to second unit to 20 hours. And you have to, I think no matter what, if it's a popcorn movie, it's a little indie dark, you have to give everything you got. And so by virtue of that, I feel like whatever any filmmaker does, if they approach it, it's the approach. You go in there and something's going to rub off.
Well, talk to me, though, about choosing the locations. Well, I guess Tokyo Drift was chosen for you, but yep, the locations for the other films. And even that in Tokyo, there's like a lot of sort of like reflective surfaces that people are standing outside of. So sort of like looking at themselves and... So a lot of touches I associate with you, you found a way to bring to that movie anyway, but just the locations for the other films.
Well, I mean, Rio was very interesting because I think a lot of people, when they talk about Fast and Furious, I think the marketing people, they talk about how, like, it's Latino, like, you know, they break it down in these numbers.
All the quadrants. So
the
you
quadrants and all that stuff. And I think at its core, it's more of a class issue. I think it's more of a working class franchise. And I mean, I grew up working class, and some of the fights that I have to have with certain people is that there's this kind of snarky attitude sometimes towards these films. I think even from people, even subconsciously, and I think you have to fight that. You have to respect the people who are going to be buying tickets. And that's not just being conscious. I think it's the approach of how you go about it. And Rio was the perfect match. I mean, as soon as you land in Rio, you see that, oh my goodness, there's like the million-dollar mansions, and right behind is the favelas. And I mean, visually, you look at it, and as a presentation of a social makeup, a class makeup.
But then the other films, I mean, going to London for the last film, I mean, it's also the sort of thing, too, where the city's sort of been, you're talking about building roads you drive on, London's kind of been rebuilt block by block and become more and more gentrified, and the people who used to live, like the East End.
It's funny, King's Cross, we were getting gentrified as we were shooting. I mean, it was like I scouted it and said, this is a great location, and we were the last crew that's going to shoot there. It's condos now. You know, so within the months that I decided to shoot there, and when we shot there, buildings were being put up, condos were being put up. So yeah, very much.
I guess too, that thing what we're really talking about for you is the way, and it's come through for everything you've done, is the way characters deal with authority.
Well, I think that's probably the Asian American in me. You know, I think also being an immigrant. Coming here when I was 8 years old, I think that's always something that always intrigued me, even as a little kid. I don't know. I've always, even when I was very young, I would always challenge. I remember in fifth grade, I was challenging my teacher because I felt like, you know, why are you calling world studies when it's all just European, you know? And she was not happy, but and you know, just throughout, I've always had that little streak in me. So. And I know that's not very Asian American, but but that's something that I don't know, I take pride in.
But it's these questions. I mean, these characters are defined by, you know, either they completely commit to authority, and you've had, you know, Paul's character break from that, or they constantly push it away. So there's this tension.
I think even authority is more about codes. I think I think how you decide to live, you know, and I think, you know, the Paul Walker character, Brian O'Connor. His code, he's the one that really gets tested, and he has to ultimately answer what that code is. But, you know, you complicate it with fatherhood, you know, which is something that I'm going through. So it was great. Yeah, I have a 4-year-old.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, so a lot of
you're really having authority tested every
day.
Oh
yeah, I just got it was tested an hour ago. I think it's amazing to kind of be on that set and just really kind of working certain things that was organic to what I'm going through with this character, just to give it a little something more.
You talk about codes, but I really feel like it's basically people, it's not just being anti-authority or pro-authority, but just the way these tensions work in the room. I mean, even in the sixth movie, after Brian is kind of like having a better time, he still like can't quite pull himself out of that thing.
Yeah, and again, I think it's that and this idea of, at least with his specific journey, you know, is trusting himself as a new father, you know, and what that means. And so, you know, I remember, especially I think on Paul in this last movie, I mean, we spent hours in the trailer talking about that. And it all led to him shooting the harpoon at the end, where he's aiming at darkness, you know, and has to trust his gut.
Well, I guess we're out of time, so let me thank my old friend Justin Lin for coming back, and thank all you guys for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an episode of The Treatment, recorded before a live audience at the Los Angeles Film Festival this year. Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.